From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, state public health officials say the case of the Solano County woman who mysteriously contracted COVID-19 marks a turning point in what is still being deemed a low-risk situation. But what exactly are we turning toward? In this hour of Forum, we look at how to prepare for a possible spike in the number of novel coronavirus cases, what to expect in terms of impact on daily life, and what the coronavirus outbreak is teaching us about our nation's ability to deal with a contagion of this kind. Forum is next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The case of the Solano County woman, who may be the first in the U.S. to contract COVID-19 from community contact, has residents and businesses bracing. The case is also raising questions about the federal government's response to the virus, including whether restrictive testing policies led to delays in learning the woman was infected. There are also concerns that the Department of Health and Human Services did not adequately train the health workers sent to help Americans quarantined at Travis Air Force Base. We look at the latest developments and take your questions about the virus. And also, tell us how you're doing. Are you already taking steps to deal with a potential outbreak in your community? We're joined first by Congressman John Garamendi, whose district includes Solano County and Travis Air Force Base. And Congressman Garamendi, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you, and thank you for taking up this issue.
You've had some strong words for the Trump administration about testing protocols and training of health workers. What are your concerns?
Well, my concern is that they, to this moment, do not have an adequate testing procedure in place, even though this virus has been circulating in China for 3 months. It's just beyond belief that the Center for Disease Control didn't plan ahead to put in place the necessary protocols on what was certain to be an international situation. And yes, here we are today. In addition to that, bringing back into the Travis Air Force Solano County area people that were known to have been in areas and quite possibly infected without the appropriate safeguards in place, without the appropriate training, without the appropriate equipment and planning is just irresponsible at best.
You're talking about that whistleblower complaint that surfaced, alleging that Health and Human Services sent workers to assist those people quarantined, that they weren't adequately trained, that some moved freely off bases, one person staying in a nearby hotel. Do you know if that happened at Travis Air Force Base, that it's the Solano County situation that the whistleblower is referring to?
We have a meeting in about 1 hour. And the information we have presently is that it's quite probably Travis Air Force Base. We will have very specific information from the Center for Disease Control. At an earlier meeting today, the Center for Disease Control and others were specifically asked about the bases. Travis, March Air Force Base in the south, and the Marine Corps base in San Diego, they said, there were no problems at March Air Force Base. I then asked, what about Travis? And they said, well, we'll get back to you about Travis. And I said, what about Travis? Can you assure us? And they said, we'll get back to you. And so we have a meeting in 58 minutes to go through that. And their response gives me a concern.
So
they wouldn't answer it at that meeting.
You're saying that you're bracing for the possibility that U.S. government workers may have spread coronavirus outside Travis?
Yes, that's precisely what I'm concerned about. And my concern goes way beyond that. And that is that the protocols for testing were at best stupid. There's no other way to describe a very, very tight protocol that only would allow testing on an individual that showed symptoms and came from China and then eventually from the cruise ship. And now it was then expanded to places where the disease was known to exist, but not allowed to provide testing to others who didn't have that specific travel history, even though they were presenting themselves with symptoms that would indicate a severe flu severe cold, severe respiratory problem, all of which are symptoms of the virus, of the coronavirus. But they wouldn't allow testing. That's what happened to this woman. She was not allowed to be tested in the facility at Vacaville. The CDC refused to do that. It was only when she got to Davis and the doctors there simply said, forget it, we're going to test. We're going to test for this. And they sent the samples off to Atlanta, where they were ultimately tested. And, oh, yeah, she does have it. The testing is absolutely essential, and there is no reason that the CDC wasn't prepared to do testing in high volumes. It can be done. Korea, within a week or two, was able to test 66,000 people.
Are you reassured by government officials now saying that they are adjusting the testing protocols and that they have improved whatever defects existed earlier with the test?
Yes and no. Yes, they did change the protocols to make it much more broad, but there appears to be different levels within that set of protocols. So that it remains those who have traveled to infected areas, and then eventually it gets down to people that are displaying symptoms. Apparently the test can be used on a broad range of the population, and that's a good thing. The second issue has to do with the tests themselves. There are no test kits available, and the best information we have today, that bedside test kits that can be used in the hospitals to immediately determine if a person is sick, are probably a week away. Samples can be sent to the laboratory in Atlanta. And late last night, perhaps because of the howling and screaming that I and others were doing, the laboratory in Berkeley and Richmond, the two California public health labs there, have been authorized now to do testing. Mm. Their request to do testing was denied by the CDC some days ago. But now apparently they can do that. I don't know if they're up and running on the testing. I hope they will be. If not now, then very, very soon.
You mentioned howling and screaming. I want to get your reaction to, you know, the White House chief of staff saying that the U.S. media is stoking a coronavirus panic because they want to take down the president, that Democrats are making hay out of this, according to his son and the president, because they want to take down the president in this election year. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I said this on national television about an hour and a half ago, and that is, Don Jr., you better not get anywhere near me. This is the most outrageous thing. I can assure you that there are 435 members of Congress, Democrats, Republicans, one independent, the same over in the Senate. There is not a one of us that wants a single individual to be sick or certainly anyone to die as a result of this. It is the most outrageous, irresponsible, but totally expected from this administration and particularly from Trump and his family.
Well, this individual, this woman, is one of your constituents. What can you tell us about her condition? Do you know anything about that or the status of tracing all of her contacts?
With regard to tracing the contacts, the public health organizations for the state and the county are busily doing that now. I have no information about exactly where she was or who may have been in touch with her, except those at the hospital. We do know that 84 medical personnel at the hospital in Vacaville have been sent home for self-quarantine. They are suspected of, well, they were in a situation where they could have been infected. It remains to be seen. Again, the testing procedures and the availability of testing should be applied to those people, and hopefully that will be occurring in the hours or days ahead. We also know that over in Davis, at the Medical Center in Sacramento, the University of California Davis Medical Center, that others were exposed there before it was determined that this woman actually had the coronavirus. There are other incidents in the Sacramento hospital system where people have presented themselves with symptoms that would indicate either a severe flu, pneumonia, or a coronavirus that have also been sent home for a self-quarantine. Now, once again, this brings us back to testing.
Yes.
And the availability of tests. One thing that I fail to understand is what the United States government is doing in its communication with other countries. Korea has a very serious outbreak. The Korean Public Health Organization immediately stepped in, immediately began testing. 66,000 Koreans were tested as of early yesterday. And there are private companies in Korea that have been licensed to do bedside testing, presumably with the capability of producing 100,000 test kits a day. To the moment, we have no indication that the department, that the Center for Disease Control or any portion of the federal government has reached out to Korea and said, hey, how's the testing going? Does it work? Is it accurate? If so, what about this company that's producing these? Does that work? Is it accurate? It is. How much can we buy? Well, you can have those things here within one day.
I know I need to let you go, but I want to ask you what you think is behind that. If there is this ability to test at a large scale, what do you think is behind this, the slow pace in the U.S. or the lack of reaching out to these other countries?
I think it's a cultural epidemic within the Trump administration. The Trump administration has paid virtually no attention. In fact, has gone out of its way to disable the organizational structures of the United States. You only need to look at the number of people that have been fired, the number of people that are that have left their job, the number of acting leaders in the key organizations, including the Department of Health Services. And so that epidemic of disregard for the organizational structure of the government leads to inefficiencies and ineffectiveness. You know, maybe there are other reasons. I don't need to go there other than to say it is absolutely true that across the broad range of government services, including the military, there is disarray, disrespect, and gross inefficiencies as a result of the lack of attention to the very fundamental process of making this government work well and efficiently.
Congressman John Garamendi, who represents California's 3rd Congressional District, thanks for joining us on the program this morning.
Thank you.
And let me tell our listeners who is with us now. We have David Eisenman. He's director of the Center for Public Health and Disasters at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. Dr. Eisenman, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good morning.
So we just heard from John Garamendi, who was talking about the processes right now that the county is going through to try to determine the people that this Solano County woman may have had contact with. Before I get into broader questions about how to prepare for pandemics and so forth, can you give some insight into the tracing process?
Well, the tracing process is really what we call shoe leather epidemiology. It's people literally finding its CDC staffers or state public health staffers helping the local health department to find out all the people that they know the contact was in contact with, the person who was sick was in contact with, all the rooms the person was in during a period of time, any transportation they took that was public. And trying to literally, like an investigator, like a private investigator, find out who else might have been in those rooms and who they might have been in contact with. Mm-hmm. And then to figure out how close were they and for how long. Because that really matters a lot.
And with this coronavirus, it's potentially a lot of people because right now the concern that it's spread through coughing, through surfaces that may have the virus on it, correct?
Yeah, so it's spread by coughing, and because of the nature of the virus like this, the droplets that we cough land on hard surfaces and can live for several hours there.
Several hours, yes.
So it's not just the people who were in close contact, like within 6 feet for a period of time of the person, but also people who might have been in the same room with the person or come into the room immediately after. It's hard to find everybody for that exact reason.
And just quickly go through the steps to limit the spread of germs and prevent infections. I mean, we're hearing, of course, that you need to wash your hands thoroughly, but other steps that people can take.
Well, the first step There are many first steps. I don't know where to start. First step is get your flu shot. And I say that not because to minimize this, but because you don't want to be getting sick with the flu and then be worried that you have coronavirus. So take that out of the equation. Number two, if you're sick, stay home. If you have a respiratory illness, I mean, if you have coughing or sneezing, stay home. Keep yourself away from people. If you have to go out, you can wear a surgical mask, but try not to go out. Among people who are healthy, the thing to do is frequent washing your hands. Washing your hands for 20 seconds or more at a time, doing it much more frequently than you normally do, certainly before you eat. And then secondly, not touching your mouth, nose, or eyes. Because when you put your hand on a surface and then touch your mouth, nose, or eyes, you transfer any germs from that surface to yourself. And that's how you get infected. And that's very hard, but you got to start practicing it now.
You mentioned staying home when you're sick, but what if you work at a job where you're concerned that you could lose your job or you could lose money if you don't go?
That's really a problem. And there's not a one-size-fits-all answer to that. In general, we want our workers to talk with their employer and to say, I'm sick. I don't want to come in and infect other people. And we hope that the employers care for the health of their customers as well as their other coworkers.
So talk about steps you can do to prepare in the event that this does become a widespread outbreak. I mean, we're hearing about, you know, keeping a 2 weeks worth supply of food and things like that, and also medications. Can you add to that list of steps that people can take?
Well, first, I think there's sort of a mental preparation. I think we need to start thinking that if this gets worse, there may be a community isolation might be required, where we shut down our schools for a period of time, or people are asked to stay home, not go out into the public, and job sites are operated differently. And so start thinking and talking with your family about how will you get through that? What kinds of plans and supports do you need for that? And just start to also talk to your employer about that. As the employer started thinking about telecommuting, about making conferences virtual, about shifts, so that less people are in the office at the same time. Just starting to have those conversations is really important. Because even if it doesn't arrive here in any big way, it could arrive in the fall. So having those conversations now is just kind of a mental preparation.
So you mean we should brace for the possibility that coronavirus might not come in a big wave until the fall?
Absolutely. The virus, we don't know how it's going to behave. A lot of viruses kind of diminish as the weather warms, the spread diminishes. People are outside more. They're in less contact with each other. So there's less transmission inside. There's less transmission because people are less inside. And then when the fall comes, people kind of return indoors and the transmission picks up. So we don't know. If we don't see a big epidemic in the United States during the next few months, we still have to prepare for the possibility of that in the fall.
Hmm. Well, we're joined now by Sarah Cliff. She's an investigative reporter for The New York Times. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So one of the recommendations also to prepare has been to have all your prescription drugs, try to get some extra drugs so that if this continues for a certain period of time, you will have those on hand. But it's very difficult because our system is set up only to provide refills when you are very close to running out of them. So can you talk about that, how to accomplish getting additional drugs, but also how that is representative of broader issues in the way our system functions when something like a coronavirus outbreak is imminent or, possible?
Sure. I mean, I think what we're going to see is that the fact we have a very fragmented and patchwork healthcare system that often disincentivizes the use of care, kind of wants patients to think twice about the financial consequences, that might become a bit of a public health weakness if the coronavirus does spread further, as the Centers for Disease Control are expecting. Like you mentioned, there's this issue around prescriptions, for example. Now, you might see, if the spread of the virus does get worse, you might see insurance plans implementing new policies that let people refill earlier and stockpile, but that's obviously a huge concern if someone is going to have to be in isolation. If they are diabetic, for example, who needs insulin, it's a big concern getting to that extra supply. Another thing that experts are thinking about is the role that the deductible plays in American health insurance. We're at the start of the year, which means most of us might have some kind of deductible that we need to pay. That might disincentivize people from going to the doctor if they're feeling some symptoms that could be coronavirus, and that could be another hurdle towards getting people the treatment and the diagnosis that they need.
Yes, it feels like there's so much ripple effect from the fact that healthcare costs are so unpredictable and often very expensive.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you still have a lot of patients who are already scared about healthcare costs, who have gone to the doctor, who have ended up with an unexpected bill. You know, I've been speaking lately with some patients who have gone to the doctor for flu and ended up with bills as big as $1,500. And now we're thinking, like, would I do it again? And sometimes they say no, that the cost is so high that it makes them nervous to go to the doctor. And it's very unpredictable, too. You don't really know what the bill is going to be until it turns up at your door.
But they say that the most effective means to trying to contain coronavirus is to detect it early and then to make sure that you know everybody that this person was in contact with. So if people are hesitant to get healthcare because of cost, then how do you detect it early? I mean, what happens to our system in that case?
I think that's a great question. And you might see hospitals and insurance companies trying to deal with this particular issue. One thing that's become more prevalent in the past few years is telemedicine, and that often is quite cheap. Insurers will offer that at no copay or a small copay. So you could see an insurance company doing something like getting rid of the copays for telemedicine. That's a great way to have visits while you're still in social isolation, to get checked out by a doctor, come in if you need to. But I think there's a big challenge of getting that message out, you know, letting people know you can come in. We're changing the policies when Americans have become so accustomed to really high and unpredictable bills that it makes them, you know, nervous to set foot in the doctor's office or the hospital in the first place.
Are you hearing any efforts to try to address folks who are uninsured?
I haven't yet. That might be something that we hear more about as if the virus spreads further than it already has in the United States. But right now, we're not aware of any particular efforts that are being done to help the uninsured.
We're talking with Sarah Cliff. She's an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and David Eisenman, director of the Center for Public Health and Disasters at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. And we're talking with you, our listeners. What are your questions about the situation? What are concerns that are top of mind right now, especially after hearing that this first case is in Solano County, a first case of potential community spread? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Or post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, at KQED Forum, or email them to forum@kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The World Health Organization has upgraded the global risk from coronavirus to very high. The most serious assessment is in its new four-stage alert system. And in this hour forum, we're looking at how to prepare for a spike in the number of novel coronavirus cases here, what to expect in terms of impact on daily life, and what this coronavirus is showing us about the U.S.'s ability to deal with a contagion for which no one yet has any immunity. We're joined by Dr. David Eisenman, director of the Center for Public Health and Disasters at UCLA, also Sarah Cliff, investigative reporter for the New York Times, and also with us now is Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, chief of infectious disease, a professor of pediatrics at Stanford University. Good morning, Dr. Maldonado.
Morning.
And so I want to just go straight to some of our listeners' questions. This listener tweets, so I've been hearing a lot about prevention. What about treatment? What should one do if someone stays home to self-quarantine? Treat it as a common flu? Yvonne Maldonado, responses for this listener?
Yes. So at this time, we don't have specific treatment for this coronavirus. As you know, these are a family of cold viruses, and so we would use the same remedies that you would use at home. for comfort and pain and just really resting. There are treatments that are in the works at this point, but there's nothing that's recommended for household members or even people who are self-isolating.
And Sarah Cliff, you know, we've heard that it's going to take about a year, maybe even 18 months for any kind of vaccine, anything to try to prevent this from happening. How do you see the vaccine being administered in our, as you described earlier, sort of patchwork healthcare system?
Yeah, so we did have earlier this week testimony from Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, who told Congress that he couldn't guarantee that the vaccine would be affordable to everybody, given that the United States does not regulate drug prices. And this is something that makes us pretty different from our peer countries. If you look at Europe, Canada, Australia, places like that, they all have some kind of government regulation of health prices. We don't have that in the United States, which is why you see a lot of challenges affording insulin and other sorts of drugs. There is, however, a pretty simple policy tool at the administration's disposal, though, to make this affordable, and that would be making this one of the level A or B preventative services. This is a suite of services that, thanks to the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies are required to cover with no copayments to the patient. So the flu shot, for example, we should not be getting copayments for flu shots anymore. So if they gave the coronavirus vaccine this particular designation, that would go a long way in making it affordable to, you know, nearly all Americans.
Well, Yvonne Maldonado, you were saying that there isn't necessarily treatment recommendations, especially for people quarantining in the home. But when they do detect symptoms, or if they test positive, what are hospitals doing? What is that treatment process?
Well, the treatment is really symptomatic. So, for example, most of these patients who go to the hospital will have fevers and respiratory symptoms. And usually if they're sick enough to go to the hospital, they have severe, moderate to severe respiratory symptoms requiring oxygen treatment, or in some severe cases, ventilatory support. There may be risks of superinfection with bacteria, so you know, there may be pneumonia, et cetera. So it's really what we call supportive care, and those treatments are pretty standard for any respiratory illness, regardless of the cause.
And so hearing that that is sort of the process right now, Sarah Cliff, like, do you think that that's something that can be done on a broad scale in the event of a broader outbreak?
I think it's going to be challenging. I mean, we just have a healthcare system that isn't quite equipped for this. And I think it's hard to know now, as we don't really know what exactly the scale of this is going to be. And I think it might vary a lot from one person to another, given that we have so many people in different healthcare situations across the U.S. I don't think we know the answer right now, and it's going to take a little while to find out.
Well, can I make a comment about that? Because,
sure.
In fact, we do have a pretty extensive pandemic preparedness system in place for, we learned a lot from our annual epidemic, which is the flu. We learned a lot from the 2009 H1N1 novel swine flu, which is now our standard circulating virus. And we learned a lot from SARS in 2002 and 3. So there are networks in place. The question, I think, is, do those networks have the capacity to be able to deal with an unknown surge of patients? At this point, we don't really know, and I think that's what you're trying to say, is that we're not quite sure what will happen, but we do have plans. Every hospital has a plan in place to know what to do right now and how to surge up if they need to. Now, those aren't fine-tuned at this point. We don't really know where we're going to be headed, but we are working very closely with county, state, federal colleagues to really try to make sure we can deal with triage and treatment.
Well, Carol asks, how can the public be protected from coronavirus when taking a taxi? They pick up dozens of passengers every day, many who are travelers from the airport and are put in a closed environment with person-to-person contact. David Eisenman, do you have any thoughts for Carol?
Well, yes. I think, first of all, for that question of getting to a taxi, this comes down to good hand hygiene. Bring alcohol rub with you in your pocket or in your purse, 60% or more alcohol, and rub your hands with that for 20 seconds or more while you're in the taxi and after you get out, and don't touch your face, your mouth, nose, or eyes during that time. I also want to address the question that was asked earlier to Sarah about stockpiling medications, because this gets at some fundamentals that we've been facing here in California for a long time among those of us who talk about earthquake preparedness. We've always been advising people to get a week's worth of medicines. And again, the practice is hard to do because of insurance. So we do have sort of three ways that we advise people to do this at our center. One is to go in and ask your pharmacist for a lost medicine override. And some insurance plans will give you that. And even if you haven't lost your medicines, you go ask and you can get an extra month's supply. Second way is to do that by asking for a vacation override. And the third is to do mail order and do get a 90-day supply and refill early, but at least have a 90-day supply in your home at all times. Now, that requires gaming the insurance system the first two ways. And that's the real unfortunate thing here, is that we're asking people to prepare, whether it's for earthquakes or pandemic flu, but our insurance companies thwart us from doing it.
Mm. Well, speaking of which, and Sarah Cliff, I know I need to let you go. Any final thoughts on how America's health insurance system may end up hurting more than helping in some cases our ability to fight coronavirus?
Yeah, I think it just comes down to the fact that there are a lot of things our system does to make it more challenging to get care. And a lot of that comes down to the financial costs of having things like deductibles and co-payments and limits on how often you can refill your medicine. And those are really going to run up against the recommendations of getting your symptoms checked out and, you know, going to get tested if you feel like you might be showing some of the signs of coronavirus. And I think we're going to see what that means for patients. The other thing we'll be watching are the type of bills that patients are getting for treatment. We've already seen one story out of Miami from a man who was in China, came back and was worried about coronavirus. He went to the hospital and now is facing thousands of dollars of medical debt. So one of the things we might run into are more stories like that, people who are following the guidelines, doing what they're supposed to be doing, but ending up with some pretty hefty medical debt as a result.
You're saying there is a chance we could see some policy changes by insurers or even the federal government stepping in. Are you confident that that's going to happen?
No, because it's very uncharted territory. We just haven't really dealt with a situation like this. You know, even when you think back to H1N1, you know, you didn't see it getting to the level where insurers were rewriting their policies. So there's just not much of a playbook at this point. But we are waiting to see what they do and if it gets to the point where they're going to make changes that take down some of those financial barriers to seeking care.
Well, Sarah Cliff, thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Sarah Cliff, investigative reporter for The New York Times. Let me go to more of our listeners, and I'll start with calls. Claudia in San Francisco. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I travel for work a lot.
Oh, I'm sorry, Claudia. I think we may have lost you there, so please try to call back. Let me go next to Nancy in Woodside. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. What's on your mind, Nancy?
My question relates to testing and getting actual accurate counts of the coronavirus should it become a pandemic here. All I know is when I've had the flu over the years, and I call my and I have very good insurance, and I call my medical group, they say stay home. And I've even said, well, you know, I give them my symptoms. Yes, it sounds like the flu. If it doesn't progress, don't come in. We don't, you know. So they don't have a setup, basically, that is safe, I guess, for people who are sick to come in to be tested. So the numbers, it just sounds impossible to keep track of something like the coronavirus. I don't even trust the numbers they've had with the flu, based on my own experience of being told to just stay home.
Well, Yvonne Maldonado, do you have a response for Nancy?
Yeah, that's a good question. And of course, I think, you know, these are, of course, estimates. It's very hard to know, given our current testing methodology. And I joined in a little late, I know I was at CDC yesterday, and we were talking about strategies for testing. And given the restrictions, the recent restrictions on testing, we don't really know the true number. But I think we have estimates, and I do think that there are some general practices that people can have. Now, in terms of how do you come in to get tested and not either expose others or become exposed yourself, that's a really good point. And there are a number of methods that hospitals and clinics have been using, which we haven't rolled out yet here in the U.S., but things such as having drive-through testing sites. We certainly did that with the H1 epidemic in 2009, where at least at our hospital, I know others did the same. They had people drive through, and somebody came out to your car and took your order there. And then if you needed a test, they could do it in the car, and then you would wait outside. And so those are the kinds of opportunities that we need to start exploring if we think this might expand, so that we can keep everybody safe, that is patients as well as staff and the general public.
Well, this listener tweets, is there a plan for local officials to work with distributors of face masks? I've been to 7 stores and looked online, and everywhere is sold out. How can we be prepared if we can't get supplies like this? I mean, David Eisenman, I've been hearing a couple things about face masks. One is that the CDC is saying that if you're healthy, don't wear one, and don't, you know, let's avoid a run on face masks because we need our health workers to have enough of those. So is face masks a good way to go?
Well, your listener points out the exact problem. By going around and looking to buy face masks, if the person is healthy, they're contributing to the shortage. We do not want people who are healthy to wear masks. It gives a false sense of security and may actually, because of that false sense of security, actually even produce more harm than good. And also it robs the supply, our supplies for people who need it. Now, in the case that someone is home quarantined, the public health department will be working with that person who's has to stay home and their family to make sure they get the supplies they need, including masks. So that's one of the reasons we saw in the bill through Congress for the appropriations for coronavirus, some amount of money for purchasing of surgical masks. The idea is that those masks would then be made available to family members who are taking care of the quarantined individual.
Well, Gene asked, should the folks who host the Oakland Museum White Elephant Sale reconsider holding it? Thousands of people in this building at the same time for hours, cash changing hands, etc. As one who is scheduled to be a cashier at this event, it makes me nervous. Certainly, there have been events canceled already. We know about the large Facebook conference that I believe happens in May that's been canceled. Other entities pulling out of big conferences like the Game Developers Conference. I mean, do you think that organizations should rethink whether or not they hold large events, especially between now and, say, the summertime when temperatures warm up?
I think this is a conversation that is had between businesses and their local health department. It's really dependent on all sorts of contextual questions, all sorts of contextual issues that I'm not able to know about. What is the possibilities in that area for disease? So I really think this is a conversation. It's a good question, but it's a question to have to your local health department.
And again, David Eisenman is director of the Center for Public Health and Disasters at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. Also with us is Yvonne Maldonado, chief of infectious disease, professor of pediatrics at Stanford University's Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. And you, our listeners, are joining us. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. And you can also post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, or email them to forum@kqed.org. Dr. Maldonado, this listener tweets, is there an increased risk for pregnant women, infants, or children? I have heard that children seem to be somewhat resistant to this virus, at least if you trust the data coming from China. But what about increased risk for infants and then pregnant women? I think, Dr. Maldonado, we've got you on a bad line here. We'll see if we can try to improve that. I don't know, David Eisenman, if you have any insights into that.
Yes, well, you're right. We do have some data from China on this, and it's very encouraging to the question. In their data set of 72,000 cases, in the age group of 0 to 9-year-olds, there was only 400 approximately cases in that group out of 72,000. And among those who died, none were in the age group of 0 to 9. And in the 10 to 19-year-old group, it was about 500 or so, 600, 700 people, out of 72,000 people who caught the disease, only about several hundred, 500 or 600, were 10 to 19 years old, and only one person out of those 600 or 700 died. So it really does look, at least from the early data from China, that the 0 to 19-year-old age range, they are less likely to get it and less likely to be very sick from it if they do get it.
And Dr. Maldonado, are you with us again?
Yes, I am. So, we were just looking at some of the data yesterday, and there's some unpublished data as well that we're tracking, most in China, as you may have said, because they have the most experience. And what we're seeing in one case, for example, several hundred women, pregnant women who gave birth, who had actually surprisingly large number of women who had who had COVID-19 infection. And seem to do quite well. And about a very small percentage, less than 10% of the babies themselves, newborns, were infected, and the majority were very healthy or had mild symptoms that resolved very quickly within a day or two.
Do you have any sense of why children are doing so well, I guess, relatively speaking?
You know, it's really hard to know. We don't really understand why this virus would be protective in babies. So the mothers don't have immunity, so you wouldn't anticipate that they would transfer that to the infant. So it's not clear. We'd like to know more about it. And it's certainly in young children, as well as you heard already, that we are not seeing severe disease as high frequency as we are in older adults. Certainly what we're seeing, and you may have heard this earlier, the highest risk group is in older populations, especially those with underlying disease conditions.
Hmm. Well, let me go to Scott in Berkeley. Hi, Scott.
Hi,
go ahead.
Just curious, not to be alarmist, but since Trump has shown a tendency to be authoritarian in ways at times, is there any concern that if the virus were to spread widely in the latter half of the year across the country, it could be used to interrupt the election process?
Huh. Well, Scott, thank you. Your question, that specific question, is interesting, but it also raises a lot of broader questions, David Eisenman, too, about the role of government in terms of being able to deal with a disaster of this magnitude. So first of all, do you think that we could the president do this, cancel an election if a situation like this gets really bad?
That's definitely not my expertise about canceling elections. I think it does get at fundamentals about trust.
Yes.
And that's fundamental to any disaster, and especially when there's sort of an invisible agent and there's this fear of the unknown. And we have to be able to trust our public officials, our government at all levels. And that's the fundamental question. What your listener is asking about is do we trust our government, and can we trust our government going forward?
And where would you say we're at with that with regard to this disaster? I mean, the president earlier this week tried to reassure the public that the government had it under control, that this was very contained, even tried to suggest that it was not inevitable in terms of coming here. So contradicting the CDC, a lot of folks felt like that was just to try to calm the markets and not necessarily because he had the public's health top of mind.
Yes, it's very important that our leaders tell us what they know at the time, what they don't know, and how they're going to go about finding out what they don't know. Instead of just giving us sort of top line glossy assurances that all is going to be okay, that never works. I think the CDC has historically been a very highly trusted organization. It's important that they maintain our trust. Among all the government agencies, CDC has always been one of the most highly trusted. And so it's really critical that we see them as above the political fray.
So what's your reaction to the fact that messaging, for example, say from the head of NIH, all of that has to now be cleared through the vice president, through Vice President Pence?
It's a concern. Vice President Pence is essentially acting as our incident commander. The incident commander is the person who needs to take a look at all the facts coming in and make tough decisions, many of which are going to be unpopular but need to be taken. And they are in a traditional incident command structure. This person is not a political figure. So I am concerned that political issues will get in the way of public health decisions and including transparency around communications.
To what effect, I mean, what impact does the president's lack of credibility generally, because, you know, it's been well documented that he likes to say things that are untrue, and the fact that he's appointed his number two to lead a situation that it sounds like you feel like needs to have an incident commander who's more like a scientist or somebody who heads the CDC or the NIH. I mean, what impact does that have in a situation like this, especially if it becomes a pandemic?
We don't know the impact yet, but it's not a good place to start. It's not a good baseline.
I mean, it basically means people won't follow the government's instructions potentially if they doubt them.
It can feed conspiracy theories. It can take away the credibility of the messenger so that people don't follow instructions. You know, and I would say that even if the CDC is doing a bang-up job of being transparent and apolitical, most people don't distinguish between the CDC and the federal government. They see them all as one entity. So mistrust of what's going on in the White House can bleed into mistrust of the CDC. And so that then bleeds into mistrust of our own public health officials in California or our municipalities. All of them are seen as part of the government. And it's a really dangerous situation when we have that.
Well, Jackie asks, why is coronavirus not considered the same as another flu or cold? Dr. Maldonado, can you also just explain the difference between flu symptoms and coronavirus symptoms as well in answering Jackie's question?
Yeah, so coronavirus is, again, coronaviruses are a family of viruses. There are 7 known human coronaviruses, but there are many others that affect animals as well, other species. So they are cold viruses. This virus in particular is different because it seems, number one, to be a brand new strain. That means no human that we know of has ever had it before, and so we are all susceptible to this. So there is the possibility of widespread infection around the world, again, a pandemic situation. So that's number one. It's a new virus. We've not seen it before. The second issue is that this coronavirus, unlike the normal cold viruses, seems to cause very severe disease in a select group of people, and that number of people is unknown at this point. It seems to be a small number of people, but we don't really know what the denominator is and how many people, of all people infected, how many really get very sick. And it appears at this point to be a small number. But since we don't know what that number is and we don't know what the risks are for getting really sick, I think that's where we really need better data to understand how to screen and prevent disease, especially amongst the highest risk. The other issue around what's the difference between cold and a flu? Well, if you've ever had the real flu, you won't ask that question. It is really a pretty significant illness, so usually a very high fever, chills, and people just feeling really, really sick, bedbound. You can't get out of bed. You can't eat. It's very hard to do anything but just lie in bed. It is not a cold. A cold, you can get up, you can walk around. Unfortunately, some people can, you know, go into public places, and that's how these cold viruses spread. With the flu, you really are going to be pretty sick very quickly, and then you're going to be down for several days to some people several weeks. So they're quite different, and I think in the medical profession, we toss the term flu around a little too easily, where most of the viruses that we get are not really the flu.
Well, Bill writes, the coronavirus can remain infectious on hard surfaces for up to 9 days. Couldn't the Solano County case have contracted it from any number of items shipped from China? Yvonne Maldonado, I mean, is this something that is on products? Should we be concerned about products from China?
No, I don't think that we know exactly how long this virus can survive on surfaces, but I don't think 9 days is right.
Earlier we heard Dr. Eisenman say several hours. But
yeah, it's much shorter than that. And I think that epidemiologically speaking, if we thought that was the case, we would probably be seeing a lot more cases right now of disease, because then you would touch surfaces from coming in from all over. But we know that this virus doesn't survive. It does survive on surfaces, but probably not as long as maybe a day or so at the most, I would say. And I think, as you heard before, probably a few hours. So I think, but it is possible if you're in a room with somebody and the, and you're, you know, and you touch a surface where they've recently touched, just very recently, that may be a risk. And that speaks to being close to somebody who's sick as a, probably the primary risk factor.
Well, we just have a minute left, and I want to get you, both of your responses to this. But do you basically feel like we're ready? I mean, I know the federal government has asked for, or the White House has asked for $2.5 billion to respond to coronavirus. Dr. Maldonado, you're saying that we have networks in place from things that we've learned about in the past. I mean, how confident are you that we can handle the coronavirus? You can start, Dr. Maldonado.
Yeah, so, well, I'm cautiously optimistic in the sense that we have been through other serious pandemics before, and we're not at that stage yet, especially in the U.S. So I do think that there's a lot of preparation going on. You've already heard about that from my colleague on the phone, but I do think that there's a lot we don't know. And we could do it. We can always do a better job. And I do think that transparency is important. Funding, proper funding for our federal colleagues who really are doing an amazing job of trying to keep us healthy. I just saw my friends there at CDC, and they are just working 24/7 and doing as good a job as you can do with this current budget. So I think we need to do more to build infrastructure and really learn more about this virus so we can understand how to fight it. We need antivirals.
Yes.
And we need a vaccine.
And David Eisenman, are we overly worried or not worried enough?
I think it's okay to be concerned and to keep an eye on the situation. I don't think one should be anxious about it now, but just keep informed.
Well, thank you both for coming on this morning and sharing your insights. And thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.